Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you very much, folks. Thanks for being with us again on a Sunday. Today we're going to talk about law, health, law, elder law in 2020. Doris Gelbman here today from Gelbman Law. We also have Beth Norton from Norton Health Law. You can find them both at Center for Elder Services. We're going to talk a lot today about issues surrounding nursing home liability and the COVID-19 issues, residents and families, and whether people can sue under, there's been a lot of loss and damage in these times. I want to start and talk about an article that was passed along to me about the senior healthcare facility in Harrisonburg. It's a long-term care homes for profit, understaffed. It was overcome by COVID-19. Have many facilities violated infection control regulations, suffered severe COVID-19 outbreaks, staffing shortages, a lot of failure under state inspection reports. They have 75 facilities. ...43% of which have one-star ratings, which is the lowest overall quality star rating that can be given, whereas only 17% nationwide nursing homes have one star. And for example, in early April, this senior healthcare facility in Harrisonburg had a hallway dance party while other facilities were not allowing residents out of their rooms. And so that leads us to talk to our guests, Doris Gelbman and Beth Norton, about what's going on and how it's affecting the residents and their families. So welcome, Doris and Beth. How are you today?
Well, I'm just great. I'm a lot better than some of those folks in a nursing home.
Hi, Rick. I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. I'd like to talk about, first, tell me the difference between health care and elder law. Because it seems to me that they're kind of niche. You can't tie those together.
I think I'm going to defer to Beth to start that conversation. I'll jump in where you need me.
Sure. Thanks, Doris. Doris specializes in elder law, which has for sure a healthcare component to it. Obviously, Doris having participated in collecting the information about, you know, this particular healthcare facility in Harrisonburg, but certainly advocating for the health of elders throughout the community. And whereas for me, elder law is a component of my healthcare practice, but it's a little more general than that. I represent patients and healthcare consumers across the spectrum, and I have a particular focus with disabled patients and disabled people in general. I have a disability practice, including disability claims, and as far as insurance, Social Security disability, and private disability policies, but also VA claims, the disability laws, both the federal and state laws. I also have a consumer healthcare practice where I represent patients in claims against corporate providers. Those relating to care and also relating to payment. Often these facilities have a habit of overcharging patients. So I assist consumers with those sorts of claims, making sure that what they're being charged for the care they've received is fair and reasonable, but also with regard to the quality of the care itself. So I have a background in medical malpractice defense. I actually have an original background in nursing. I was a telemetry cardiac nurse for quite a few years before going to law school here in Charlottesville. And then I've spent the last 6 years primarily in a corporate practice, a healthcare practice, first in Norfolk and then in Richmond. I did medical malpractice defense for several years and then switched more to a focus on risk management and compliance issues. So, in that practice, I was able to become familiar with the laws that, govern the delivery of healthcare, the regulatory requirements for providers. And, what I've found is that providers have teams and teams of attorneys like me who are advising them on what they have to do. The care that they have to provide patients, but very few patients actually have familiarity with the laws that protect them and that dictate the kind of care that they're entitled to. So, my practice is focused on that the healthcare laws that pertain to the quality and payment issues for care, and advising patients in those areas and helping them to assert their rights to that quality of care and again, those payment issues. So that's really, I do have an elder law practice, but certainly Doris has, her practice.
Why have you lost
that? It's hyper-focused on elder issues. She's certainly the expert in this area on all the other elder law issues. And she's certainly actually been a great resource for me when I've had questions on those issues. But hopefully that gives you an idea of the difference between the two.
If I could just add, I think that it helps to make it a little bit clear is that if it's not already, that there is a fair amount of overlap between our two practice areas. But we do have distinct knowledge bases that are different from one another. So Beth has a lot more knowledge about the medical side of things, and I have a lot more experience and knowledge about specifically about the elderly in those settings. And to give you an idea of what she's talking about, I think when we talk, as lawyers talk about regulatory systems and compliance and those kinds of things, when you look at that article, Rick, that you were referring to before, some of the regulations have to do with, who the staff is and what care they're supposed to provide and, what kind of measures they're supposed to make in order to make the place safe and what kinds of things they're required to chart. All of those kinds of things are embedded in regulations along with lots of other things. So Beth's expertise in regulation and compliance is very, very helpful because it levels the playing field for her clients. I have a good deal of experience with that, specifically in nursing homes, but she has a much broader base of knowledge in health providers generally.
So if we do that, if that's the difference, where does care fit into the title legally and otherwise?
So I have always kind of bridled a little bit about including the term care in my practice at all. I do not provide care at all. I'm a lawyer and I practice elder law, which, if it factors in at all, it's that my job is to ensure that people do receive the care they're entitled to receive. I am not a medical professional, so I don't practice any of that. I can help people find the care that they need and make recommendations about various facilities and those sorts of things. But Beth might have a different answer for that.
Yeah, so as far as care goes, it's obviously a big part of my practice is focusing on the care that's been provided, and then, of course, the payment for the care that's been provided. So the vast majority of my clients will have, you know, what they're calling me about is directly related to health care that they've received or that they're going to receive. With Doris and I both addressing elder issues and addressing planning, and Doris certainly has a lot of knowledge about the providers, people who provide healthcare in the area. My practice focuses a great deal on the actual care provided, both, you know, helping people to assert their rights regarding the care and, their payment issues regarding that care. There is a side of my practice, too, that just relates to health. For example, disability work that I do doesn't necessarily pertain to any particular health care that a person has received, but more along the lines of the law for people who have certain health conditions. So it pertains to their health rather than health care. So my practice sort of focuses on both, the person's individual health and then the health care that they receive.
Again, our guests today, Beth Norton from Norton Health Law and Doris Gelman from Gelman Law. You can find them in Charlottesville. Ladies, I started talking about the healthcare facility in Harrisonburg and the fact that there were some issues about the state inspection reports and some of the choices that were being made there. In early April, after the COVID-19 virus had become quite apparent in senior care facilities and in just the regular household, can you talk for a moment about nursing home inspections being sharply curtailed after the pandemic starts? One of the bits of information in this article was that this company, part of which was this Harrisonburg facility, had suffered severe COVID-19 outbreaks and staffing shortages, according to state inspection reports. And we'll get into other articles about how, because of the way things are going with loss of staff throughout the state, people not being sent into buildings, not all the inspections are being done.
So I'm going to back you up just a little bit on this because I want to preface everything I'm going to say by at least one statement I'm pretty sure Beth will back me up on. I think it's really, really important that people understand that I have nothing but 100% support for the people who are providing care in these facilities, the CNAs, the nurses, the med techs, even the environmental and dietary people. They have worked their hearts out. They are devastated by these occurrences, and it is no fault of theirs that any of this is
Absolutely.
Happening. So I want to make that very, very clear. And, you know, we as not even as providers, we are very supportive of the community that is caring for these people night and day, working 12, 15, 24-hour day shifts. Really fighting for people's lives, and we support them in every way possible. As far as the inspections go, I think you have to wind the clock back a little bit and understand, and specifically in the article that you're referring to, the violations that are reported in there are before the COVID crisis happened. And this is a problem throughout the nursing home system and assisted living system, but we're mostly focusing on nursing homes. And the staff shortages are not a result of the COVID crisis. The COVID crisis is a result of the pre-existing conditions in the nursing homes. This was a petri dish waiting for this virus to drop into it. It was ripe for this outbreak. They've had outbreaks of norovirus before. They've had outbreaks of flu before. They lose patients every year to various outbreaks and infections, MRSA infections, you name it, they get it. And the staff shortages are not a result of the illnesses. They're a result of wanting to make a profit on the backs of the suffering of the people that live in these places. The people who own the nursing homes, in order to make a profit, short-staff them in order to save the money on staffing. So along comes this infection, and it gets a foothold or a toehold even in these facilities, and there are not enough people to take care of the people that get sick. Then the staff themselves get sick, and many of them are. Trust me, there have been people that have died, doctors, nurses, aides, and many of them quit because they were frightened of taking this thing home with them. So there was indeed an even greater shortage, but there has always been a problem with staff shortage. So that needs to be very, very clear, that it's the cause of the outbreak, not the result of.
Beth, am I hearing that there's an issue here between patient care and profit?
Oh, absolutely. Like Doris said, that's always been the case. I worked in it. I lived it. And when I was defending facilities in my medical malpractice defense practice, it was the number one cause of every lawsuit that I was defending these facilities from against. And there were any number of issues that were secondary to this problem. For example, we had a lot of cases that involved patient falls because there was inadequate staff to help the people who are unable to, for example, get up to use the bathroom by themselves or, to ambulate by themselves. You had falls, you had cases of bed sores and just general neglect. It caused any number of issues. And then, of course, when you have an outbreak like this, it just compounds the issue, and one feeds into the other, and you end up in a deadly cycle where now the short staffing contributes to the COVID problem, contributes to the short staffing, and eventually you just end up with a disaster, which is what we've seen and what Doris has really brought a lot of attention to, including in this article. So yes, it was something that I've experienced both from the clinical perspective and from in my own practice, in the liability of these facilities. One of the things that I think what Dora said was really important to note is that the staff themselves are victims of this as well. Staff burnout is it's an inevitable reality in nursing and particularly in the CNAs and again, particularly in these long-term care facilities. You come to work and you've got 30 patients, as an aide. That's not unusual to be responsible for keeping people, appropriately turned, because if you're not, if patients aren't turned, they get bed sores, and keeping them, clean, their hygiene. They're responsible for so much, and it causes so much stress and burnout. So it's really, both the patients and the staff themselves are the victims here. And I always made a, point of when I was defending these cases of making sure that there was a distinction between, you would have a plaintiff's attorney talking about, the substandard care that these nurses were providing, and it was like, wait a minute, you have to take into account. And of course, I couldn't point out how short-staffed the facility was, because then I'm admitting liability as a as an attorney, but it was a reality, and I was always very, very protective of my nurses when they were, you know, in depositions or on the stand, that they weren't treated like the villains here. They are truly victims of this as well.
It's Beth Norton from Norton Health Law. We also have Doris Gelman from Gelman Law as we talk about health and elder law in 2020. Let's take our first break and we'll be right back. Thanks for sticking with us here on 97.9 The Wren. Glad to be back for another week. I'm curious, ladies, when and why did we switch from care to profit at these facilities? Who wants to take on that question first?
Well, I have to wipe the saliva off of my chin because I just can't wait to get into that subject. So Beth, I hope will forgive me for leading off. It is a real bone of contention, you know, for people who are in this business. First of all, I think it's really important to note that medical nursing facilities, as we know them today, are a relatively new phenomenon. For historically, it really wasn't until like the 1940s that we began to house people in quote unquote nursing homes. Typically, people were taken care of by their families in their homes until the day they died. And there's two reasons for that. One, that was just the way it was. Families took care of their families. And the other reason was people did not live long extended lives with this long period of health decline. We keep people alive artificially and perhaps too long, which is why they end up needing a facility like this to take care of them. We also keep them in ICU and cardiac units and hospitalized way longer.
Yeah, so like Doris said, you know, historically we took care of our elderly family members until they died. And there are a lot of reasons why that changed. I mean, you know, not to throw women under the bus, because I'm certainly a working woman myself, but, you know, it used to be that women were at home taking care of the children, so they would also take care of their family members. So that definitely changed. And I don't know, and maybe Doris can speak to this better than I can, but I think profit has probably been an issue, at least when the switch was made between charitable organizations were operating a lot of these nursing facilities a long time ago. And again, I think Doris can probably speak better to the history of that. But, you know, like the Catholic Church and a good number of healthcare facilities, including nursing facilities. And of course, they're nonprofits. And again, Doris, I think you can probably speak better to when that shift occurred, I think probably in the 70s or 80s, that that we made the move from these not nonprofit organizations and a lot of religious organizations to then these for-profit companies.
Absolutely. And some of them are still around, you know, for here locally, for example, Our Lady of Peace is still owned by the Catholic Diocese, I think out of Richmond, and Westminster Canterbury is owned by some some church-affiliated Church of the Brethren or somebody like that. I can't remember. So they're nonprofits, and they provide very good care. There's also government organizations. For many, many years, veterans have been cared for in you know, retired service people's nursing homes, those sorts of things. And that's been around for a long, long time. What I was getting ready to say, though, in terms of the way people died back, you know, for most of our history, people died at a much earlier age. If you look at the early part of the 20th century, just as recently as like the 1920s, people did not live beyond 50, 60 years old on average. And what happened is you're at home, you get the flu, you get some sort of infectious disease, TB, pneumonia, the flu, something like that. And 3 days later, you're dead, right? You did not linger in care for a long period of time. And so that's what happened. And so when we started particularly following the Second World War, when we started building these what's known as a medical model of nursing care, which is what we have today, one of the things that happened very quickly was the difficulty in paying for care for a long period of time. And that's where Roosevelt and subsequent governments stepped in, and they created Social Security, and they created Medicaid, and they created all these ways to pay for people as they aged. The other place that this grew out of historically was poorhouses, right? We would sentence people to poorhouses, and they would grow old there, workhouses and poorhouses. So, you know, we have a long history of housing people in that way. So Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid were all put in place to take people out of poverty and to care for them as they age. But of course, they could no longer work. So that's where that came from. And that also would contributed to the idea, well, how are we, the providers, going to make money because the government is telling us how much we're going to make? And there's this very, very complicated mix of how they admit patients, how many Medicaid patients they're going to take, how many Medicare patients. Those are people who are receiving rehabilitation, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and they're there only for a short period of time. The government reimburses at a much higher rate for what's known as skilled care as opposed to long-term care, which is paid for by Medicaid or privately.
Here's a question for you. So, again, our guest, Doris Gelman, Gelman Law, Beth Norton, Norton Health Law, as we talk about these questions, who is making the money? Because, as I mentioned at the start of the program, there's a facility in Harrisonburg who was in this article, 75 facilities, the one in Harrisonburg, just one, that received a single star rating, doing things that people are going to frown at, and... who is making this money? These are not independently owned people with the guy with the curly mustache standing on the side of the building, twirling it, trying to trick people to come inside.
That's Snidely Whiplash is his name. He is standing out there, but he is nowhere near the building. Mostly they're in California or New Jersey or someplace like that.
And he's got friends now.
Yes, he has friends, and they're called venture capitalists. And for the most part, these nursing homes are parts of large chains of nursing homes. You have very rare to have a small independent or family-owned nursing home, or even a chain of nursing homes. They are owned by a distant venture capital group, private. It is not traded publicly. There is no information available about them. There's no, they're not traded on the stock market, so there's no reporting that's done. There's no regulation of how much money they can make. The money is paid out to the other shareholders in this thing, and it's generally a very small circle of people. And what they do, and this is a relatively recent occurrence, is what happened is they began buying up failing nursing homes. And what they do is they create a shell game. So you have this venture capital company, Snidely Whiplash Venture Capitalists, and those folks go out and they create something called an LLC, a limited liability corporation, or an REIT, which stands for Real Estate Investment Trust. And so it's a shell game. They have all these little entities set up, and that's who technically operates the nursing home. So say, for example, they get a bad inspection like the one that you're talking about. The folks that lose their license to operate it, if it gets that far, is the LLC, not Snidely Whiplash Venture Capitalists. They carry on. They just open the doors again under a new LLC name. In this case, the ones that you're talking about are the Accordius healthcare companies. It's public information. We can name them in Harrisonburg. There's several of them scattered all up and down the East Coast. If something happened to Accordius, they shut it down. They declare bankruptcy for Accordius, not the venture capital company that owns them, which I think is Porta Piccolo or something like that. They carry on, and they just change the name and start all over again. They also, the operators of these organizations, they basically are operating the building. They may hire the staff and manage the payroll and do all that sort of thing. But they may very well also contract with yet another shell company to provide dietary services, to provide linens, to provide physical therapy services. All of these different things are different entity. And guess who owns them all? Snidely Whiplash, right? So any one of them gets into trouble, but they are all paying money to Snidely Whiplash for the privilege of – they're contracted to the venture capitalists to provide those individual services. But the money is all ending up in the same place. But if you ask a nursing home operator, Accordius, they're saying, oh, we're not making enough money. We're close to bankruptcy. We can't continue to operate this way. And that's true. They don't themselves have any money because it's all going to the owners.
Beth, that's how that happens. Beth, let me ask you. So I've heard you mention lawsuit or court case several times. Let's say that my grandmother is indeed 97 years old. She doesn't live in a nursing home. But if she did, and she happened to pass away from being in the dance party at the Accordius healthcare facility, and I wanted to go to court from it, how do you help me in that? Do we get anywhere with this case?
Well, in the case of a dance party, I would have to say absolutely. So here's the number one difficulty right now, and you, maybe you've heard a little bit about this with these, you know, nursing homes and the COVID-19 situation, is that at least here in Virginia, the governor has issued an executive order, which basically triggers these two statutes that the Virginia legislature already had in place. These two statutes basically make it that healthcare providers are granted immunity under certain circumstances, particularly when you're operating under a state of disaster and you're providing care in those circumstances. But this executive order that the governor signed basically has declared COVID-19 to be one of these disasters that triggers the immunity provisions applying to healthcare providers, you know, responding and providing healthcare during COVID-19. The issue, though, is that that doesn't cover gross negligence. So it only covers ordinary negligence. And the way to think about ordinary negligence is, you know, everybody makes mistakes, whether you fail to understand a situation or comprehend a situation, or you just, you know, your attention was diverted somewhere else. We all, you know, have lapses in judgment or in our attention spans. That's ordinary negligence. And that happens every day. And during, you know, a case of ordinary negligence, you've got immunity under these circumstances because they're operating under, you know, presumably these facilities have had a shortage of resources, including human resources, which again was nothing new, but it definitely was exacerbated under the COVID-19 disaster circumstances. And then, of course, you know, we had shortages of the personal protective equipment, things like that. That's ordinary negligence. Gross negligence is when you make a decision that you know, or you definitely should know, could cause somebody harm. Having a dance party in April, when we've already got all of these CDC guidelines and the CDC and CMS, that's the Center for Medicare and Medicaid services, which really govern a lot of, they issue a lot of the regulations involving healthcare, and not so much the assisted living facilities. In fact, they don't regulate that at all, but they do have regulations, and so does the state governing nursing facilities. They've issued guidance by April that we've got to, you know, maintain social distancing. I mean, by April, all our schools are closed. We're all at home. We're all working from home at this point. Everybody's used to, or at least getting used to, the idea of social distancing, and you're having a dance party in a hallway with people who you know are at risk at this point. We know in April that, you know, the elderly, the people who are in these facilities, the residents, are at a particularly high risk. I would say, I don't know how anyone could make the argument that's not gross negligence. So yeah, that would be the theory of recovery. If you were to bring a case in court, you would argue that, you know, this facility in Harrisonburg was grossly negligent by holding a dance party. And if your family member got sick as a result, and particularly if they died, then you would bring a wrongful death or, gross negligence.
Hang on a minute, Beth. Our phone is starting to ring off the hook with people wanting to sue right now. So let me go answer this. I'll be right back.
Well, let's take a break. Let's take a quick break and come back, because it leads to a lot of other material to cover, and we have the third segment of the show, and I'll let you catch us up on, because I feel like we've only opened the bag, and there's so many things to pull out. So let's take our next break and be right back. Beth Norton, Doris Gelman, as we talk about health law and elder law in 2020 and the COVID-19 virus and how that plays into it. Hang tight. And here we are, another Sunday. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. And thanks to the Wren for making a space for us here on Sundays. Our guest today, again, Beth Norton, Norton Health Law, Doris Gelman, Gelman Law. You can find them both at Center for Elder Services here in Charlottesville. We were talking about the governor's executive order and how it extends an immunity to healthcare providers and including nursing facilities. I'm curious, and Beth, you were talking about this. There are other states doing similar things, and it's not specifically implied to the COVID-19 virus, but it seems to have come about because of the COVID-19 virus. Is that correct?
So those two statutes that I talked about that the legislature had passed were already on the books. Basically, they're kind of those Good Samaritan laws. If you've got a public disaster or some kind of emergency situation, it provides immunity to healthcare providers, so that they're not afraid of, you know, providing care under, you know, challenging circumstances. You've got a lack of resources because, you know, for example, let me just like use Katrina as an example. There were a number of lawsuits and even imprisonment in the case of some facilities and healthcare providers because they just didn't have the resources to get everyone the care that they needed. You know, they had to kind of triage on the spot who was, you know, somebody who had a good chance of survival and would get this care, and somebody who, you know, maybe didn't have as much viability. And so they would, you know, unfortunately, they would have to, you know, omit healthcare and under certain circumstances. So a lot of states have these laws on the books. What the executive order did was to clarify that COVID-19 counts as one of these disasters, so that healthcare providers wouldn't be afraid to be, you know, providing healthcare in these circumstances where, for example, a ventilator needs to be used for two patients. That's just not something that, you know, is ordinarily done. You go into a hospital and you're in the ICU, if a patient's on a ventilator, they have their own ventilator. They've had to modify equipment and get really creative in how they can extend limited resources to cover these new challenges, this increased population of people on ventilators and ICU, and then, of course, even masks. I mean, you just see how, people are afraid to operate. They're afraid to open themselves up to liability by providing healthcare under these circumstances. So the real purpose behind the governor, and, if you read the executive order, his preamble kind of goes into the reason for him making sure that to clarify that COVID-19 counts as one of these disasters and extending this immunity. We had supply chain interruptions, and these are some of these things were just unavoidable. Masks, they were nowhere to be found. All kinds of, like I said, all kinds of resources being severe. We had severe shortages of these resources. So in order to, just to kind of give a little bit of comfort to these healthcare providers so that they would actually go in and provide the healthcare that people needed during COVID-19, they had to provide this immunity. As of last week, there were at least 18 states that had granted nursing home and other care facilities some sort of legal immunity. Now, while Governor Northam's executive order didn't specifically apply to a nursing facility, it certainly the law counts nursing facilities and nurses as healthcare providers. So it does provide that general blanket immunity over all healthcare providers. And again, it's changing daily. Like I said, as of last week, there were at least 18 states. Some of them, it was actually surprising to see that they had not granted immunity. For example, Texas had not, as of last week, extended any kind of immunity to healthcare workers due to COVID-19. But again, it had a very specific purpose, and it was intended to assist healthcare providers and give them some comfort given the circumstances. Some providers, though, went to extraordinary measures to kind of mitigate these effects, and some did nothing. And some went, having a dance party. That's just, shocking. And that's actually one of the things that the courts, the Supreme Court of Virginia, one of the ways that they describe gross negligence, which again, this immunity does not extend to, is, behavior that would shock the conscience. If having a dance party in the hallway of a nursing facility in April doesn't shock your shock you, that's, I don't know where your head is, but that's the executive order. It didn't necessarily create this immunity. It was already there. It just extended it to make sure that to clarify that COVID-19 counted as one of these disasters.
I was just going to say, I think the way to think of that executive order is that it was a trigger. So when Governor Northam issued the executive order, he triggered the already existing law into effect because this was an emergency situation. I think one of the things that is really important to point out is that events that happened before the emergency declaration are not covered under the emergency declaration immunity. So, for example, if you've got a very high infection rate, and some of these, outbreaks that we had in nursing home actually came about because of events that happened before the emergency was declared. So it'll be interesting to see how much litigation springs from the fact that these nursing homes were short-staffed before. That's a factor. A lot of lawyers are going to make a lot of money on that stuff.
Well,
but maybe Beth.
I want to toss some info out on this one. This was a national story. I heard this on NPR as I'm driving to work. Canterbury rehabilitation and healthcare center. It's a nursing home in Richmond. Houses 160 elderly, roughly half of whom African-American, most on Medicaid. By mid-May, 80% of Canterbury's residents had been infected with COVID-19. 33% are dead. Even before the pandemic, the facility had a poor reputation. On March 18th, a Canterbury patient was diagnosed with the virus. Does Charlottesville, Albemarle have any facilities like that or opposite of that?
I would say that we have a full spectrum, and I'm very cautious, first of all, about those star ratings that people refer to. I frequently caution people not to pay attention to the star ratings. They are statistically, the way they're calculated, are not accurate. And they're also inconsistent. So from one inspection period to the next, and they're done every 15 months, at least every 15 months, you might have an inspection report that results in you getting a one-star rating one cycle, and then the very next cycle you end up with a four-star rating. So there's a lot of problems. I don't want to get into the weeds on the statistical problems with them. But what's interesting is the underlying data. You can actually go on the website and look at the databases that these stars are calculated from and read the surveyor's reports, what the violation was, what happened, what the plan of correction was. All of those things are available. You can read them. And if you go back and you look at Canterbury, by the way, just to be clear, this is not Westminster Canterbury. It is Canterbury Health and something. It is a nursing home in the Richmond area. And prior to being Canterbury, it was a place called Lexington Health and Rehabilitation, and they had a very poor reputation. It became Canterbury when it was bought by a venture capital firm out of New Jersey. I forget the name of them. I think it's something like Trotsky or Tripsky or something like that.
When Snidely Whiplash bought it?
Snidely Whiplash bought Lexington, changed the name of it, thinking, oh, they have this terrible reputation and this terrible one-star rating. We're going to change the name of it, and that's all we're going to change. And in fact, their next inspection was as bad or worse than the previous inspections have been. All of this is prior to COVID. So once again, you have this Petri dish full of bad conditions, short staffing, poorly trained people, bad infection control, bed sores, and lots of other factors that are just waiting for this thing to drop in. And that's what I'm talking about, the conditions being ripe before the emergency that actually caused the outbreak to happen when it came along. And, you know, I think that those people, you know, their feet can be held to the fire. I would certainly be looking at it.
Well, one of the things that I think it's important to note, particularly on the staffing issue, is that, you know, we don't have any standards in our state, in Virginia, such as nurse-to-patient ratios. We allow facilities to decide what is reasonable. That's really the term that's used in the regulations, is that, you know, we facilities are required to have reasonable staffing, reasonable staff to patient ratios. And when you do that, you really are putting the fox in charge of the hen house. You're allowing this facility, which, you know, and even getting into kind of the corporate model of healthcare, you've got an inherent conflict, right? So corporations have a duty of loyalty to their shareholders. They have a duty to provide the greatest return on investment. But healthcare providers have a duty of care to their patients. And obviously these things are in conflict. One of the ways that, you know, it's not the most popular, one of the most popular ways that these corporations save money and make money for their shareholders is by cutting on their most expensive resource, which is staff. So, you know, it's certainly a hot button, I think, for both Doris and I. We both think it's just crazy that we allow the facilities to decide what is reasonable when it comes to staffing. But you can see what, you know, what happens. You end up with a disaster. You've already got a shortage of staff. You're already operating in a understaffing situation. And then COVID hits, and you need, you know, in those circumstances, especially when now you have your residents who are confined to their rooms, they're not in common areas, so you need more staff. You need more eyes on these people who are now all separated into greater rooms. And then, you know, you're not protecting the staff. That's actually another area of liability for these. It's not just the patients who have been affected. Again, it's the staff themselves. They were, you know, put into this awful situation too. And they operate under this, you know, short staffing situation every day. So it's, you know, I think those are the two things that you need to keep in mind with these corporate providers when you start talking about profit here and how it really affects the care that's given. And then particularly in a situation where you're, you know, fighting this pandemic, is that, you know, we don't regulate the number of staff that are required. No, there are no, you know, staff to patient ratios in Virginia, and you've got a conflict of interest, an inherent conflict of interest when you've got a corporate provider.
Well, we're getting low on time left, so I mean, limit where we're going with this. But Beth, we've talked about lawsuits and going to court for you. So, Doris, what do I come to you for here? What's my purpose to go to Gelman Law for in this situation?
Well, one good reason is to watch my hair burst into flames every time I hear one of these stories. It's very entertaining.
Does my mask cover my nose properly for that? Burning hair is not the best smell.
Yeah, and to be frank, it's really very, very difficult for me to help anybody in these situations, and there's a good reason for that. And you implied this at the beginning, at the very top of the hour when we started talking, when you talk about the fact that there is no one that has eyes on these people right now. So if you have a family member, for example, that's in a nursing home or an assisted living in this case, you can't go in and see them. You don't know how they're being cared for. You don't know how many people are on staff. You don't know that they're being turned to prevent bed sores or they're getting their medication or anything else because you cannot see them. You can barely get them on the phone. You're lucky if you get through. What's worse is the other people who normally monitor these situations, and very specifically the state of Virginia has the Office of Licensure that conducts the inspections. They call them surveys. They were not going in. I believe they just restarted doing those. But those, for months and months and months and months, there have been no licensing surveys going on across the country. The Department of Social Services, Adult Protective Service workers, who they go in and deal with people who are suffering from abuse or neglect or financial exploitation, they have not been able to go in. The Ombudsman Program, which is a third-party advocate for nursing home or assisted living residents, their people have not been able to go in. No one is allowed in these places to see what's going on in them right now, including me. I can have care planning meetings with the staff, with the resident over the phone or by Zoom, for example. I can do that and advocate and talk about what's going on with them. I have been able to, you know, via Zoom, see my client that's in a nursing home. So if they're not doing well, if they're losing weight or anything else, I can actually see that by Zoom. But it is extremely difficult. There is no transparency whatsoever right now.
I just wanted to mention that there's just nobody in the Charlottesville area who knows the number and the nature of the resources here, you know, for elders than Doris. Doris knows you know, all of the administrators and the people who dedicate their services to, you know, older people, you know, elders in this area. I mean, Doris knows them all. They all know Doris, and they all respect Doris. There's just no greater advocate than her here in town.
Okay, the check's in the mail, Beth.
But is anybody hiding from Doris? Which I guess is the question.
I'm sure.
In this situation, with everything that's going on, if they know Doris, we want to know the ones that are hiding from Doris.
Well, Aquarius is not terribly happy with me right now.
Shocking.
Who is that?
Who is that? In Harrisonburg.
It's the
facility. But I think what Beth is not, the thing that is not apparent is part of the reason that I am able to help people solve issues in these facilities is that I do not automatically take the side even of my own client. I do know these people. I know the people that run them, the local management. I know the nurses. I know the CNAs that work in these places. I have developed relationships with them over the years because I know that you get way more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. I do not go in shooting from the hip and making demands and those sort of things. I'm going to start out having a conversation with people and working towards a solution and not just harping on the problem. I don't think you get anywhere that way. I understand the constraints they're under. I understand that they have a corporation they have to answer to. But I don't let them off the hook that way either.
Again, our guest today, Doris Gelman, Gelman Law, Beth Norton, Norton Health Law. Ladies, just 15 seconds each. We can find you where on the internet?
You can find me on my website at www.gelbmanlaw. Spell it G-E-L, B like boy, M-A-N, law, all one word, gelbmanlaw.com.
Beth?
You can find me. Yeah, Rick, I can be found at www.nortonhealthlaw.com.
All right. Thanks to both of you for coming in today. And you can remember that they can be found at the same building, Center for Elder Services. It's crazy what you read about in the news. I guess, as Doris said, there's two sides to everything. The folks who work in the buildings are working their hearts out for Snidely Whiplash. And their voices need to be heard sometimes as well. And we'll try and do a show in the future to let them speak. Thanks very much, ladies.
That would be awesome.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.